Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Faith Church Podcast. I'm your host, Jay Williams, and joining me today is Jeff Clossy.
Hey, Jay. Good morning, man.
It's been a couple weeks.
It has. Yeah, the snowstorm canceled us last week.
Yeah, we just got dug out.
Yeah.
It was pretty great, though, on Sunday to be everybody to be together after being snowed in.
Yeah, that's a unique feeling, and especially because this one wasn't just like a day-long thing, right? It was several days where people didn't go to work, and some people had to, right? You know, but a lot of people didn't. They couldn't.
No, and did you feel like COVID flashbacks?
A little bit, yes.
I did when they were just canceling school so early, and we were just like, okay, and we're not going to be able to go anywhere, and driveway's not going to be cleared out, and
will this end? Yeah. You had that feeling, right?
There's definitely a feeling. It was both... You know, like, do you remember back in COVID that the first week or so there was kind of like, well, this isn't so bad. And then it quickly, you know, like, it was kind of fun. It felt like adult snow days when they just said, listen, you can't go out. And like, okay. And especially for me, because there was the NCAA, well, we thought there was going to be the NCAA tournament. Like, right away.
It was a similar time of year, wasn't it?
Yeah. And so I thought, okay, well, this won't be the worst. And then it was the worst. It was really, really, really the worst.
Thank God we're back out now. It is weird. I was thinking this morning, it's Tuesday morning, we're recording this, how last week we were still all, for the most part, snowed in, depending on where you live and where your driveway was. And how that, for me right now, at least, that feels like a really long time ago.
Well,
it was only a week ago.
And my favorite thing are the youpers saying, like, what are you guys worried about? Like, 3 feet of snow? That's nothing. It's just life.
Uh-huh.
It's just and it is funny how, depending on what your culture is used to, like, it's very common for upper Midwesterners to make fun of people in the South when, you know, in Atlanta or whatever.
Oh, they
when
get three, like, inches and it's
they
over,
get three
right?
inches, yeah. But people don't realize, like, yeah, but that's icy and frozen and people are not used to it and they don't have the equipment to deal with it, you know? So it's, we are not, in our area, are not quite set up like if you were in, you know, way up in the upper peninsula, like at Michigan Tech or whatever, where they're just like, we're just assuming we're under feet of snow for 8 months of the year. So you just, everything's designed to deal with it. But anyway, we are out. We missed a Sunday, which is sad. And then we come back to you talking about the wrath of God, which I think is fitting. Because I think when people think of Jeff Clossy, they think that guy loves talking about the wrath of God.
Yeah.
It's just like you have a 30-second conversation with you. And you're like, oh boy, but this guy loves, like, I'm being sarcastic.
I met some new friends on Sunday too who don't know me. It was their first time.
Oh,
and
that's so
I was
great.
Like, hey, I just wanted to make sure you're aware, you probably assumed it, but we don't preach on the wrath of God every Sunday. In fact, we haven't for quite a while, not like this concentrated form.
Right.
Just to make sure they knew, like, cause if you don't know that, you might be like, oh gosh, this is heavy. This is intense.
Yeah. Well,
which it is. And there's no way to make Gethsemane not intense.
Correct. No, there's not. So I think here'd be my question to kick things off then would be, okay, so first of all, why did you demand that I let you preach on this passage?
Yeah, here we go. Everyone listening's like, yeah, right. Fast forward.
Why did you rip this out of my hands? No, like what? So when you were asked to preach on this passage and you think about the concept of the cup of wrath and just this whole scene in Gethsemane, which, by the way, is really interesting because one of the things that I've thought when I read this passage is how did Matthew, Mark, and Luke know what this prayer was? Like, we don't ever really get that. We don't know, did Jesus tell them what he was doing?
I think they were probably close enough where they could hear.
Were they close?
Yeah,
did they hear
that's
it?
That's my guess. But
but they were asleep, though.
Yeah, that's true.
So I don't.
But it's short.
You know, was it revelation? Was it like? Did they piece it together? I don't know. It's just one of those interesting things that you're just that pop into my head of going like, okay. But what when you started thinking about the concept of the wrath of God, how did you filter through starting with, you know, all the ideas, all the things you could talk about in it, what you thought was most important as it related to Gethsemane? How did you end up where you ended up?
That's a great question, because this passage for me, when I read it, if I just read through it, I see like multiple different sermons So, and I've used this one more as a side thing in the past when I've been helping people learning how to pray and pray honestly, because I do think this is a prayer sermon as well. Like, how do we pray? And you could focus the entire time more on that, because Jesus, I think, gives us an unbelievably perfect example of how to pray through suffering and wounding and horror with this prayer. And I touched on it briefly, but that wasn't the main thrust. I think my heart goes to so much that I have feel like God has taken me on a journey with this, as probably most of us have, when it comes to the wrath of God. If you meditate on it much, like how I feel now when I hear that phrase, even the wrath of God, is very different than me even 15, 20 years ago would have felt about it. I no longer feel like I need to come up with excuses for God's wrath or reason, like apologies for it. Maybe that's the better way of putting it. Like, I think there was a time in my past where I would have felt that. Now I really do, with the framing that I gave on Sunday, I hear it as very good news. Very, very good news because of what it says about who God is and how he responds to evil. But if you don't have like the key of Jesus, right, and drinking that cup, it is the worst news you can imagine, right? Because then it's pretty hopeless. There's really no escape, because we realize that we're all part of the problem, right? If it's like the person who says, why does God allow evil? Ultimately, in that conversation, you get to the point, well, what do you want him to do about you? That's right. The question, because we all are part of the evil that we really hate and makes life really difficult. So anyways, I was really excited that I got to preach on this. I also wanted to say what I could say in that amount of time and not go too far, you know, like give people enough, realizing this is one where, yeah, I think you could take it a lot of different places. So I took it to the places where, for my own heart, and then for people that I've walked with through pain and suffering and difficulty, have been the most helpful. That's kind of how I chose the course.
Makes sense. I mean, it is a difficult thing. I think one of the hardest things about preaching about the wrath of God is that it very quickly can go sideways in our hearts. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, there are some people who hear a message on the wrath of God and they want to hear it. They want it to be preached because they're thinking about other people.
Yeah. They're thinking about the Serbian sniper I talked about.
Right. Yeah. And they're like, good, I want God's judgment. I want his wrath to be poured out. And it's almost then becomes a cover for their own, their own anger. And so that's not good. So when we talk about, okay, God's very real wrath towards sin, trying to guard against that for people's hearts, that it doesn't go in that direction. And then you have the other direction where people then feel like God's wrath and God's love are these two different things. And if God is angry, then he can't be loving because we personify it or we humanize it. And we think of like the definition of human wrath, and that does not elicit any kind of imagery that we would attach to also loving. You know, that it's not, we just don't, we talked about this before with Jesus being angry. It's not the same thing as when we are angry typically. And I think you did a really good job of trying to really zeroing in on why God having wrath is really critical. So I think that was a good choice to say, okay, well, first let's, it's not even like first, but a big chunk was to say, you don't want a God that doesn't have wrath. You had that line. I don't know if you got this from somewhere or if that, this is your line, but the horror of a wrathless God.
I don't know either.
Cause I thought that was, well then kudos, because that's a brilliant line that stuck with me. Could you take a minute to just unpack that line again? I mean, I know obviously you said it and you talked about it, but that's such a powerful line, like the horror of a wrathless God, because we tend to want to apologize for it, or we weaponize it. So either way, it's sinful.
Yeah,
we are off track. When we either are delighted by it, like it feels like vindication or anything like, oh, good, they're going to get what they deserve. That's not fruit of the Spirit at all. So when we think of God's wrath like that, so that's what I'm trying to like wrestle with, is how do we see it as good and not go, but not it from an evil point of view, you know? And that, so what is the horror of a wrathless God?
Yeah. I mean, it's a God who is indifferent to injustice, right? Who looks at it and says, basically shrugs shoulders and says, okay. And like, imagine how horrible in the face of things that, we know cannot be dismissed. Like, and I think, you know, I didn't have time to go into this, but like when it comes to the thought process of our current age, this, all of this requires us to, you know, maybe I should have gone here, but it requires us to have this base understanding that there are true moral evils and there are true moral goods. So we're not talking about like our preference when we talk like this. We're not talking about, I really like chocolate ice cream and you really like vanilla. It's actually like this, there are certain things that are morally wrong no matter what anyone thinks about them, no matter what anyone's preference is for or against them. They are that bad and they're wrong. And they, those all flow, we know what those things are based on who God is. When it's not of God, it's horrible evil. When it is of him and like him, then it's good. So if we have a God with, who's just wrathless, who doesn't respond to injustice, to evil, to the things that aren't like him, it makes him indifferent even to himself. I think ultimately it's like, he doesn't really even care about his ways. He's just indifferent, as if his ways don't matter. And he'll just take his cues from us or something. It's just, and you can apply this, I think, in any, like, sometimes when we think about injustice, we do think about, this person did this thing to someone else, but it could also be something like an illness, right? Like, God cares about that. I think he reacts to it as well. And so, yeah, that's what I was getting at there. And the more I dwelled on that thought, I think that there was a question that someone asked, like, what would it be like to have a wrathless God? And that's where that thought came from. I thought, oh my gosh, that is horrible. That is a nightmare to be in that situation, because then what's up and what's down? I mean, it really is disorienting if you actually put yourself there for a moment in a universe where that's not at base. Like, I mean, it also would mean to me that he's not loving. I just can't grasp how, again, back to the father analogy with a child, I don't know how a father whose child has been harmed could respond with a shrug of the shoulders. It just doesn't add up that person would be loving towards their child.
No, or yeah, any kind of dismissiveness, mm-hmm. or well, just get over it. And, mm-hmm. Or comparison. I mean, it's a wrathless God could also be a God that's like, well, you guys have done way worse to me, so just get over it. And
yeah, that's interesting.
That's not what he does. But like you mentioned, the problem is we don't want it aimed at us, right? Like we think we want to, like, if we're able to grasp it. And I think some of it, so I mentioned the humanizing or personifying, but I think we just so picture, and even when I've heard people try to deconstruct, or the whole idea that the cross is, you know, cosmic child abuse, you know, that, but it's because you're picturing this in like human terms, right? Like, you're picturing it as, okay, here's this just out of control, angry dad and the son, you know, the cool younger generation. So, I mean, like, there's some of these weird images we get, like, steps in front and it's like, no, you know, be cool, dad, you know,
yeah,
like,
the uptight dad versus right. the.
And that's, I love how, right. And I love how you pointed out that this is a Trinitarian act, that they, that the Trinity together in perfect unity is enacting this plan. And they each, you know, in this mystery that, you know, the mystery of the Trinity, they each have their role that they are playing, or not role, but they each have the action that they are taking, but then it is also a unified action. And, I think that's really important, but it's really important, I think, to realize that God's wrath is not, it's not an overreaction, like an angry overreaction to honest mistakes. Mm-hmm. And I think that when we are thinking about it in our own terms and we think about like, oh, you're saying when people get really defiant or really like, well, who is God to, you know, judge me, or I'm basically a good person or whatever, we're picturing God's wrath as an overreaction to like, so like a dad who loses his temper and screams at his kid for leaving the milk out.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of stuff where
like misplacing the remote.
Right. You know, and yeah, should you have left the milk out? No. Like, but it was a mistake. You know, it wasn't sin. And I've noticed that a lot of people, when they talk about their own sin, it's always defensible, right? It's always like a mistake. It's always, and so when you think of it in those terms, like that's where it feels like, well, then you're overreacting because yeah, I know I lied, but I didn't lie like this, or I didn't, it wasn't that big of a deal, or, you know, whatever the case is. So we just don't like it aimed at ourselves. But the reality is that, you know, we're not typically so gracious to other people. We don't typically come up with a defense for other people. And we've talked about this before, that in our flesh, we want justice for others and mercy for us. It's the parable of the unforgiving servant, you know, who is forgiven this massive debt by the king and then goes out and has a guy who owes him just a small amount of money thrown into debt prison. Because that's just how we're wired. So I do think that's part of the misunderstanding is we have to, in order to see the wrath of God as good, we have to actually believe that sin is evil and is rebellion and in all of its forms. And just because, you know, when Jesus connects anger to murder, he's not just using hyperbole. He's talking about the root of all these things, right? And so, you know, one way of thinking about it, and maybe this is on the fly, I'm thinking of this illustration, but I'm thinking of like fentanyl, where it's like a little bit is lethal, but it's like nobody would say like, well, we're going to put a little bit of fentanyl in this, you know, or we'd only... It is evil and it is destructive regardless of how small it is. And it's a principle of the world that small things become big things, that things spread, that leaven, you know, spreads. It's leaven can be both like a picture of the kingdom and can be a picture of sin, you know, that is it's all the same thing. And that's Jesus pointing that out of like you can't be self-righteous about not having committed murder if you've been angry at your brother, because that's the same thing. So just because you might have a little bit more self-control or didn't have the opportunity or whatever the case is, it's still the same root sin that's going on there. And once you realize that and you realize that, okay, well, if God is going to be dismissive of my sin and my rebellion, that would mean that he's also dismissive of everyone else's, which then means there's no justice, that he's apathetic to our suffering. He's indifferent to injustices in the world, which is ironically the two biggest criticisms I hear from people who don't really understand the gospel. They'll attack God for why does he not care that evil happens in the world? And they'll attack God for, well, why is he so angry about sin? And I'm like, well, you do realize that that's contradictory, right? Like he can't both be apathetic and super angry, like something. And so it's almost like then the enemy twists that in such a way that then what ends up coming out the other end is a picture of God who is indifferent to real evil, but is like overreactionary to simple mistakes. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that he should just get over.
Right, like so he doesn't care that there are children starving in the world, but he seems to be really angry that I accidentally left the milk out or I told this little lie.
Mm-hmm.
And I always find that interesting. Do you find that interesting? Like there's this weird kind of, it's not all or nothing, right? Like it's not, nobody ever, and that's the trick of the enemy. So here's what I mean by it's not all or nothing. You don't have a person. If you were following it logically, and if I had a picture of God that he was really angry about every sin that I committed and every little sin, then it would follow logically that he was even angrier about, you know, trafficking, you know, or grand scale human suffering. but it's not. We think he's one. We say we attack him for being one way and then the opposite way. And the reverse is true, that if I thought he was dismissive of the evil in the world and indifferent towards it, then logic would say then he's really indifferent to my own things. Well, then I can do whatever I want. And he's not angry with me. But we're not consistent in our picture. It's very common for a person to classify God as indifferent to evil in the world, but also really angry about my little mistakes.
Yeah, it really strikes me, Jay, and I agree with you, by the way, how you're saying that. I think that's exactly right. It strikes me how this concept especially, and God's love as well, there's a lot of theology that we need to have straight in order to understand it. So like you mentioned earlier, you know, the divine child abuse idea, right? Father versus son. If we don't understand the Trinity and the Trinitarian nature of God, Father, Son, and Spirit, we misunderstand this, right? We can make some conclusions that aren't accurate, that don't correspond to reality. And I think the same goes for the nature of evil and sin as revealed in Jesus and his kingdom. If we don't understand that, like you mentioned, the small things becoming big things, or even just take in the Sermon on the Mount, him teaching about to anger in your heart towards your brother, right, is the equivalent of murder. And David Paulison, Christian biblical counselor, psychologist, he says something like, I don't think this is exactly right, but irritability, like being irritable, is murder in seed form. And I think that's really powerful. So once we have an accurate understanding of what is a human being, how are we made, what is sin, where does it come from, then it makes more sense why, like, kind of downplaying what we would consider, we would probably even say it was a mistake. We wouldn't even use the term sin because we can't come to do that sometimes. We just can't face it. Why it's so important. And it's not that God is a nitpicker. Like, that's not the way he is either. I mean, we have other passages. Psalm 103 is one of my favorite, where it says that he knows that we are but dust. He's compassionate for us, and he knows that. So, like, he knows the hand we've been dealt. He knows what it's like to be a human. He took on human form. He gets all of that. And he's not, like, not taking that into account as he looks at us and interacts with us. And he's just. And he's not going to sweep things under the rug, because that would violate who he is. And I think it's interesting, again, I didn't have really time to go there, but one of the key passages that in the scriptures about who God is and his love versus his anger is in Exodus, right? Exodus 34, 6 and 7. Those are the ones that passage, if you look that up, that passage is the one that's quoted the most often, like throughout the Old Testament and the Psalms and on and on and on. But that's the one where it says he's slow to anger. So he's slow to anger, which, that's the category of wrath, but he's abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. So I tried to be careful how I said it as well, that he's full of love and at times with great patience is how I said it. At times and with great patience, he's full of wrath. And that's what I was trying to get at, is that he actually, and we've loved the book Gentle and Lowly as well, also an amazing work that covers some of this, but that love is who God is all the time, right? And the strange work for him, that's another way of saying it, or the slow work is his wrath, right? And I think that's the other danger, is that some people, you kind of highlighted this earlier, but because of maybe personality, wiring, or whatever, have tended to overemphasize his wrath, like to the detriment of understanding that he's a God of love. I think that's possible. Yeah. As well, and some people have maybe grown up in that, where they hear more about the God of judgment than the God of love, and that's also lopsided. So you need to be careful about that. But I think one of the reasons this passage in Gethsemane is so powerful is that it's not spoken to us in terms of like theological, like a systematic theology. It's revealed to us in a real story and really something that happened to Jesus. So we see it and we feel it and we experience it along with him, the nature of it and his reaction to it. That's what's, as I was writing and prepping, that really struck me so much about the passage, is that Jesus, you cannot find another spot where he reacts this way. Like, it's just so extreme. And it was like he alone understood. No one else could grasp it, what he was what he was heading towards, much less that he was going to physically die. They couldn't even really get that. But they had just gotten done talking about how that none of them will betray him, right? And he knew they were going to. Yeah.
You know, you said that you're talking about how, like, love and wrath actually go together, which is different than anger.
Yep.
Like unjust anger or and just think of how you would describe somebody. You know, if you picture a dad who loves their kids, and you, like, what comes to mind if you say, oh, that you would describe them as a loving father? And like you mentioned, if some suffering befell their kids, you would expect there to be wrath or anger. But nobody would then say, would then classify that person as an angry person.
No.
Right? Like, so if you know a person, if you know a father who is mild-mannered and calm and loving and gentle with their kids, and then, you know, like I ran into this all the time coaching with parents, you know, there are some parents who are volatile and some that you just knew them to be very, very gentle, very loving, very encouraging. Like, that's just what you knew them to be. If I, like, walked into a gym and saw one of those parents that I've always known to be very loving and gentle and caring and calm, saw them getting angry, my immediate thought would be, what's going on? Right? But there are other people who I might go, like, oh gosh, well, whatever. Like, I'm sure, like, who knows what it is this time that Jeff's getting riled up about or whatever. But there's a huge difference between that, you know, between those two reactions. And I think that's the thing with God, is he's abounding in steadfast love. That when Dane Ortlund calls it the wrath of God is strange work, it's because it's in that context. It's in the frame of like a loving father who, like, when something happens and they are wrathful, like, then you would say, what's going on there?
Yep.
And I think I would tease that out a little bit and say, kind of what you said about, like, you're gauging your response based on, you know, how Jesus is reacting or whatever, like, that should kind of calibrate your response. Well, the same thing should be about God's wrath. Mm-hmm. So because his nature is love, and because he is abounding in steadfast love, because all through Scripture the norm is his love, when we see his wrath or when his wrath is talked about, our response shouldn't be, well, man, what an angry God. What an overreaction. Our response should be, wow, how serious is that? Just like if you think of the calmest person you know and you walk into a scenario and they're really angry, your first thought would be, oh gosh, what's happening? Like, what is going on here that is eliciting that kind of response from this person that I know to be calm and loving?
Yeah, I love that. And it's true. Like, the person who is an angry person, a human being, when they yell, people that know them don't even react.
Right.
Because it's just, like, normal. There's nothing going on. This is just normal.
Right.
Which is so sad. But the person who isn't that way and then they react, you know something is going on. Like, this is really, we got to pay attention. And it's indicative of a situation that's calibrated properly to the situation, because they are healthy, right? And God's love and his wrath are always perfectly calibrated to this circumstance. It's to him that we know, like, by looking to him, that we know if ours is accurate, right? If we're overreacting or underreacting. And because that's part of the issue with us, is we overreact to stuff all the time, right? We make things a big deal that don't need to be. And we choose to be offended when we don't have to be. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think when we then take that by analogy and then apply it to God, we can imagine that he would be that way, but he never does that. He's never making something a big deal that isn't. He's never overreacting. You know what I mean? He's never choosing an offense when he doesn't have to. It's always a perfect response, which is really hard for us to get because we don't experience that in ourselves or other people.
Yeah. His reaction is never out of proportion to what's going on. And here's what's ironic about it is when we accuse God of being apathetic and not caring about the evil, like, why does so much evil happen in the world? Well, and God's not doing anything about it. The irony, of course, is that what we want is for him to respond in the irrational hair trigger way that we would respond. you know, this is why we've mentioned before how I personally can't handle watching revenge movies. Like I don't watch them because it feeds something. It feeds that, like, oh, I want justice and I want it to look like this. And I want it to, and I'm not saying they're inherently bad for everyone, but that this is the problem, is that we're like, well, he's not doing anything. Well, what would you have him do? And it's typically going to be some kind of sinful response that would not, it refutes the idea that God is loving and patient and long suffering. God is not the father who flips out without, you know, without thinking things through or just kind of responds in the moment. He doesn't do that. He knows exactly what's happening. He knows the heart. He sees through to the heart of everything. And he is long suffering. He is patient. He is enduring. And so when we say God's not doing anything, that's not true. It's that he's not doing what I think he should do. And so now all of a sudden I want him to respond in a way that I would not want him responding to me, by the way. I mean, can you imagine if justice was immediate all the time? Like there was no allowance for repentance. Like any one of us can think to the worst thing that we have done to someone, or any moment where we are just like, man, I sinned against this person. Well, how thankful are you that God gave space for repentance and didn't just immediately? Now, he has struck people down. In scripture, we've seen that. We've seen immediate justice, but it's never like reactionary, like impulsive or anything. That since the foundations of the earth, like I think of Acts 5 and Ananias and Sapphira. Well, God, that was not an impulsive reaction that God strikes them down. Like that was planned before the foundations of the earth. Like he knew that was, like, he's outside of time. That's not a thing for him to just be like, oh, he gets super angry and just strikes somebody down. But I just think it's interesting that so often our critiques of God and how he handles evil and how evil has come about, there's a lot of just strange reactions that we don't, or accusations that we don't think through. So if God was apathetic about it, well, then that means he'd also be apathetic towards you. And isn't that great? Well, no, it's not actually great, because we don't want a God who is apathetic or indifferent to our suffering. But we also are really thankful that he is patient and long-suffering. And so when you really, like, when you zoom way out, you realize, no, God is doing something about evil, but he's doing it in the best possible way that will achieve the best result. And we have pictures of this, right? Like, we understand that if someone steals your car, you could go and get faster, quote unquote, justice by going after them and harming them and taking back your car, or you could call the police and they could be arrested, and the justice system is much slower. But we would all say, but that's going to be a better result in the end. It's going to be better for you that you didn't become a vigilante, that you turned that over. It's going to be better. It's just going to be better in the end. And so that's kind of what we have those pictures. We have a lot of pictures in our world of things that we say, well, the immediate response or the immediate quote unquote fixing of it isn't necessarily the better thing. And so then do we trust God that if we can look at his nature and his character and say, okay, he clearly is not indifferent towards evil and sin. He is going to make all things right. And he's going to do it in such a way that we will be able to experience eternal joy and satisfaction in that justice. That's pretty mind-boggling. And I think sometimes we, and I might talk about this next week, but sometimes we depict the whole cross and God's wrath being on Jesus, not only as this cosmic child abuse situation, but then sometimes in trying to get away from that, we depict it as God got backed into a corner, and then what choice does he have? So the bridge illustration, you know, where like the imagery or the story, I don't know if you ever heard the story of like a train, you know, like
I have heard this.
Yeah. A train's barreling down the track and he's got to choose, like he's got to switch the tracks, and is one train only has his son on it and the other train has all these people on it. And so he makes this choice, and it's meant to kind of give perspective or compassion for God of like, oh, he had this choice. But what we inadvertently do in that is we undermine his sovereignty and undermine his intentionality, and we undermine his omnipotence and his omniscience and everything, because you're backing him into a corner. Like the enemy played this chess game with him and now has backed him into this corner, and he's got to make this choice that nobody would want to make. But that's not what he does. Like Satan is constantly playing into God's hands, not the other way around. Satan did not back God into a corner and won some small victory on the cross, but God ended up turning it into something good. God is orchestrating all of this because he's bringing about the best possible world for us of infinite, ever-increasing joy and peace, and a world that is will actually be eradicated of sin, which is beyond our comprehension. And I mean, like that's, yeah. So I think not letting us get into those things, which goes back to what you're saying about not apologizing.
Yeah. And it's wild to me, you know, so if we took like the idea that we take it into our hand to make things right, you know, like we're going to be the executors of justice, mm-hmm. we can't handle it. So like it darkens us to do it, to deal with it. Because like you said, like even the revenge story, the reason that there can be such an enjoyable thing to watch is if you feel like this is getting set right, but in the process, the people doing it are actually, they are not the same afterwards. They're diminished. But God can deal with it and actually not be diminished and actually be just reflecting his perfection and his glory and his mercy and grace and his justice all at the same time. And so that's, to me, that's one of the things I think we can take comfort in. Like you said this earlier, but the things that are wrong will be set right in the best possible way. And part of following Jesus is for us as his disciples to say, and we aren't able to comprehend, just like the disciples in that moment were not in the garden, we can't always imagine what that would be to make it right in the best possible way. We just can't. Even though we know the story, it's still like particular evils we've experienced, we can't unpack it, but we can trust him. And that trust is based on the other things we do know firmly about who he is and how he's revealed himself.
Well, and therein lies that's so often the key. We've talked about this before with the promises of God, you like to say, don't misuse your imagination. Well, sometimes that happens in justice because we think, okay, well, this is what justice would look like. And then when God doesn't meet those expectations, then we doubt his goodness or his just nature. And the same thing happens with promises. When we say, okay, God promises us this, but we start to flesh out, well, and this is what he promises to provide, and this is what provision is going to look like.
Yes.
Or he promises that, if we trust him, that we will receive good gifts from him. And then we'll say like, well, this is what those good gifts mean. And then we get upset that God doesn't deliver on promises that he never made. And so the thing is that we have to remember, so similarly with each of those situations, the goal is to trust his character. And so we've talked about before with promises of like, don't trust so much the thing that's going to happen or how it's going to happen, but the one who makes the promise. Like we tend to think, oh, I don't think I can believe God for this because I can't imagine how this is going to happen. I can't imagine how this could actually be for my good. Like if I don't lie about this, then I might get fired, you know, and I can't imagine how that could be for my good. So now I'm going to manipulate the situation. And the question isn't, okay, well, how is he going to do it? The question is, who's the one making the promise? Like, put your trust in the nature and the character of the one who's making the promise, not your ability to imagine how that promise is going to be fulfilled. And the same thing goes with justice and how he's going to make all things right. We'll drive ourselves crazy thinking about like, well, how is this going to be made right? How can I possibly be satisfied in this? Why does it seem like, and you see this in the Psalms, why do the wicked prosper? This like this has been going on forever of looking at it and saying, God, why aren't you doing something? And so then the question though isn't, well, what should he be doing? And what would justice look like? And how did this person get away with it? Like, we can't let him get away with this. The question should be looking at the nature and character of God, and do you trust him? Has he demonstrated a seriousness, you know, towards sin, or has he demonstrated an indifference towards it? Has he demonstrated a willingness to and an ability to make things right in history, or has he shown himself to be kind of indifferent and unable to do that? And if he is who he says he is, well, then trusting him for justice rather than looking at the circumstances, which is critical in forgiveness, because that's a huge part of forgiveness, is giving over justice. Like when in Romans, when it talks about how God says, vengeance is mine. And Paul says, like, so deliver that over, give it over. It belongs to God. You can trust that he is going to make that right. And you can trust the end result is that you will look at it and say, justice has been satisfied and served, and it'll be satisfying. And that's what I just keep, like, look at the end result that God promises and his character and nature. It's a little bit like trusting somebody who, or like when the pilot says, you know, of the airplane, hey, we are going to fly to, you know, to San Diego, and that's where we're getting. And I've been a pilot for 30 years and I know what I'm doing. We don't even think twice about it. We don't think about like, how does the airplane actually work? We don't think about, you know, if you had no frame of reference for what an airplane was and you just looked at it and somebody said, that's going to go 30,000 feet in the air and just glide along. And it's going to be like sitting in the waiting room or sitting in whatever. You're just going to be hanging out, you know, like it would be just mind boggling because we just would not be able to understand how it works at all. And we still don't understand, but the reason why we can get on an airplane and be like, well, and not freak out about the fact that we're 30,000 feet in the air in a machine that has no propellers and no, like, just like what in the world is going on, is because we trust that people know better about what's happening. And what are we all thinking about when you're on an airplane? You're thinking about the destination. Now, if there's a lot of turbulence that happens, well, then all of a sudden you start thinking about the plane and you start thinking about, you know, when the captain gets on and says, hey, we're going through a little bit of weather, but we're going to get through this or whatever, then you calm down again. But ultimately, all of this stuff is happening, but you're thinking about, okay, well, what it's going to be like when you land. What's the weather like in San Diego? What's it going to be like? What are we going to do when do we need to go get our rental car or whatever? And sometimes I think about that with eternity of like, okay, sometimes when there's some turbulence or whatever that happens, I just kind of like, okay, there's nothing I can do about that. And then I might start thinking about, oh man, it's going to be fun when we land, in San Diego and we get to the beach. There's a reality to that of eternity, right? That okay, yes, there's turbulence, but the question isn't, can you figure out how the plane is flying and what do you need to do to like make sure that you, like, you don't. You're not the captain of the ship. You're not the captain of the plane. You are a passenger. And so just like your job typically is as a passenger on that is to stay calm and to just like let the captain do what the captain's doing, because that's who you trust. Only the captain on this grand flight is a perfect, all-knowing, all-powerful God who knows exactly where he's taking us, knows exactly every bit of turbulence is by his design so that the destination is even better. It's not reacting to some other force that he can't control. It's him orchestrating all things together for good. And that is just very difficult for us to wrap our brains around, because it just, I mean, one, we have to admit that we are dust. He already knows that we're dust. We don't like to think of ourselves like that.
Yeah, we're pretty, a lot of times we get in a mode, even if we wouldn't say it, where our actions and our emotions, they reveal that we think if the world just went how we thought it should, it would be, you know, much better for everybody, because we think we know.
Right.
And we often really don't. We don't understand all the factors. And I think that goes for even our understand, like what you were saying about the destination and the bumps along the way, or even the comprehending how it all works. I think it's good that we attempt. It's good that we're wading into God's wrath and trying to, you know, wrap our mind around it and how the cross works. What's Jesus accomplishing? That's actually really good, but there's a limit. There's a limit to our ability to fully get it. And I don't know, and God knows that. He's not surprised that we cannot fully get it. And thank God there's not exact understanding and comprehension of all these things is not necessary for a faithful following of Jesus. I think understanding it more deeply is important and valuable in following him, but we aren't going to fully get it. And for me, the longer I walk with Jesus, the more being okay with that has been helpful, of just knowing there's going to be things that I can't fully wrap my mind around, but that would be exactly what I would expect to be the case if what I'm talking about is an infinite being. I'm not infinite, right? I'm finite, so I'm never going to be able to fully grasp why and how he does what he does. But we can know Jesus, and I think that's the other part that, I guess as we think about landing the plane here, Jay, that I want to kind of end on is to think about what does it look like for us to continue to know Jesus, the one who would say to his Father, not my will, but your will be done, in the face of losing really what he had enjoyed for eternity with him, right? Being alienated from him and separated from him as he took on that cup of wrath. For us to know him in that is, I think, instructive, not only on our, it will give us security and confidence in our own walk with him and our own connection with him, our salvation, but I think it will also help as we walk along outside other people who either don't know him yet or who are suffering significant things right now in their life. This story, this account informs how we can pray with them, how we can pray alongside of them, how we can respond to them in love and with open hands that God is going to work and he's going to do often what we couldn't have imagined that he would do because we just don't know. We're not the expert. So yeah, I think that for me is the other discipleship application of it, is this account, it really does require a response from us. And I think each one of us will have a different sort of response. There's not just one, right? And I want to encourage people, if you hung with us this long through the podcast, to think about that and to ask God, what is he doing in you, and how is he calling you to respond to this scene in the garden? You know, this scene of faithfulness on our behalf.
What does trusting him in that, and what does it look like to have that kind of radical trust that he is good, he is loving, he is patient, he's merciful, and he is not indifferent to our suffering or to evil, and he will bring justice, and he's doing that for an end, for us to be together with him, totally satisfied. Which, you know, it's one thing to picture eternity without sin. That's a really great thing to think about. What would it be like to interact with people and in situations and with the world without sin, but also to be totally satisfied in justice and in awe of God's ability to bring justice and peace? Because that's where the peace then comes from, of just to be totally at peace. So we want to walk alongside of you as you kind of wrestle with those things. We hope that also, like you mentioned this in the garden, of it is this model that it's okay to express those things. And so maybe you're wrestling with something that you feel like this has been this great evil, and I don't know how to surrender this to God. We are available to talk about those things. We aren't none of this is flippant. None of this is dismissive of like, oh, then we don't suffer, or no, not at all. There is great evil. That evil is a real thing. Our trust in God is just the anchor for our soul, that we know he will make all things right. And in the meantime, he gives us all kinds of tools of how to deal with that. He gives us lament. He gives us righteousness and anger against the injustices of the world. He gives us the ability to comfort one another and to have compassion for one another. He gives us so many gifts in the midst of it. So if you have any questions about that or want to wrestle through any of those things, you can reach out to us at connect@faithpeshtigo.com or talk to us on a Sunday. We hope that this conversation has been helpful to you, and we appreciate you taking the time to listen. Until next time, grace and peace.